Welcome at the Coalface. I am Philippe Rose. This is a conversation among friends working in international affairs. We share stories about our life in the real world, beyond the headlines, and look for lessons learned that can inspire us. If you're enjoying this podcast, please help us out by clicking the follow button on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever way you're listening. Leave us a review and consider becoming a supporter by visiting atthecoalface.buzzsprout.com. And a shout out to our current supporters. Thank you for making this show possible. In this episode, I speak with Alberto Mondrond. Alberto is originally from Cape Verde and moved to the US as a child. In our conversation, we explore the impact of growing up in an environment with bullying, racial and social challenges. Alberto shares how he turned these negative forces into a source of strength and self-discipline thanks to martial arts, leading him to use this wisdom to serve his community. He shares his journey into electoral politics to drive change to Cape Verde and how he's today putting all of his skills to work in science diplomacy as senior fellow in the Emergency Preparedness Research, Evaluation and Practice program at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, focusing on fascinating international, multidisciplinary and multi-stakeholder programs ranging from countering violent extremism to human trafficking. Hi, Alberto. I'm really delighted to catch you on this early morning for you in the East Coast and evening here in Singapore. And I've been really looking forward to have this podcast episode. We've known each other for a number of years, and we've tested this idea of doing this episode for some time, actually. So finally here we are, finally here we meet. And I was thinking when I was preparing for our conversation, I was imagining you and you always come with me. You always come with this association of Capo Verde, which is a country that is magical for me, that has so many interesting and mysterious association. And for me, of course, it's associated with the singer Mayra Andrade and her song Terra Longi, and there's this little paragraph like a mie figlio di roccia chi ben tu leste fulian ama ten tu mi tendes ilia capo verde o capo verde.
Wow. And
just that kind of
that's impressive. You deserve an honorary passport for that.
So I just wanted to kick off with that, actually, and bring us kind of back into your childhood growing up there, what it was like, what were you talking at the dinner table, and just what are your happy and maybe less happy memories of that time?
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity, Philippe, and it's a great pleasure and honor to be here and to be in this podcast and to share some of my story, pretty much. And you started with a place that is very close to my heart, which is Cape Verde, country that I was born, of course. And, you know, I had a very simple family life. We grew up in a small island. The island is a volcano island, the island of Fogo. And life was very simple back then. And it was not complicated like it is today. So, you know, we had a very secure childhood, very close family knit in a community, small community of about 400 families in the village. And it took a village to raise a man. So, as the old saying goes, and we had the opportunity to have a very secure and comfortable upbringing with lots of family and, you know, very family oriented environment and community. Supported environment as well, where everyone worked and helped each other in challenging times. And that was, the early stages of my life. And I was actually educated and went to school in Cape Verde up until more or less I was 8 years old. And then we immigrated to the United States. My family has had longstanding history of immigration to the United States. So it made it very easy to make that transition during the late 80s. And we came to the United States as an immigrant, and we had some roots in Boston already with grandparents and uncles and relatives. So it made it very easy to come and install ourselves with our family here, with my father, and everyone came together.
And it sounds like a common trajectory, actually. This yes. I find so fascinating in the history of your country, this straddling of East and West and very mixed and identities that seem very comfortable with that as well.
Cape Verde is a crossroad right in the middle of the Atlantic, as everyone knows. And it's a small island nation, and our population is really around 560,000 people. With very diverse, mixed cultural, ethnic heritage, but that has been more or less like a petri dish of global connection, as a place where, you know, the crossroads of Atlantic trade routes, and it goes all the way back to the beginning of the founding of the country with the Portuguese, and it was a former Portuguese colony. But moving the conversation along, Cape Verde's played some very important role in its history, but not many people know, related to international security, related to commerce and trade. That goes all the way back to the time of Elizabeth I, expeditions of Sir Francis Drake and also with Darwin being stationed in Cape Verde for more than 6 months to do some investigations in the island. So these are some interesting facts that relates to Cape Verde. And also, Cape Verde has played a very important role in the New England industrial coming of age in that sense, because without the whale oil, the New England industrial complex and industries would not have taken shape the way it has. And Cape Verde and the Macronesia Islands have played an important role in supplying oil, whale oil in those days. And that actually is how the connection was established with the immigration and to the United States and to New England specifically. And then eventually President Fillmore issued a directive to Samuel Hodges, who was commissioned to open up a diplomatic post, which is the very first in West Africa in 1818. And that was established in Cape Verde. So that was our first connection, and that was done to combat the slave trade and also to enhance maritime security for commerce between the United States, Africa, South America, and Europe. And that's one of the important things that a lot of people don't know about Cape Verde, and very few people know. And then during, the World Wars, Sir Winston Churchill, sent many troops to Cape Verde, about 5,000 troops, to anticipate and actually prevent Hitler from invading the Macronesia Islands. And when he couldn't invade the Macronesia Islands, he decided to change and go to Plan B and invade through North Africa. So that's how the North Africa invasion came about. And it was because Cape Verde could not be invaded, given the advanced intelligence of Winston Churchill and his operation.
It's a really fascinating, history, and I find also that link of the importance of the diaspora in the US also really, really interesting. And yourself, your own history, straddling both cultures. And I'd like maybe to put the spotlight a little bit on your early life or young life as a young adult. What did you set out to do? What was your what was motivating you, and how did you start essentially?
Well, when I immigrated and came to the U.S., I started at a fifth grade level, elementary school, and then we went to middle school. And during my middle school years, it was very tough because I was caught between cultural crossroads here in New England in a melting pot. But for me, it was the first time that I started to experience discrimination and racism. And that was very challenging for me. And as a matter of fact, it did affect my life tremendously, that it, it drove me to want to learn martial arts, because I was bullied and picked on tremendously during my early years. And for that reason, I sought ways to defend and protect myself, and I ended up in a martial arts studio. I was lucky that there was a gentleman that came back from the Korean War and opened up a Taekwondo studio in the neighborhood, and that was my luck because it changed my life. And through the martial arts study, I was able to develop not only the ability to defend myself, but confidence and self-esteem and ability to set goals and develop a strong sense of inner self and at the same time be very goal-oriented and driven. All of that came from the martial arts training because, as you know, it takes many, many years of lots of sacrifice and dedication to become a black belt. So that goal was accomplished. And after that, throughout high school, I began to train and compete locally. And that took a route of itself where I did very well. I was supported by my instructor. And it wasn't easy, but eventually I won Massachusetts State Championship. And then from that point on, we started to travel throughout the New England region and compete. And that experience took me to the national scene. And then I became part of the United States karate team, which was formed right around 1991. And thereafter, we represented the United States almost all over the world. And that gave me another whole level of experience and exposure through the sports and through the competition. I began to see the world in a different light. And still today, I have friends all over the place from those experiences. So it's fantastic.
I'd like to maybe ask you to deepen a little bit when you talked about the bullying you experienced in New England. Can you say a bit more about, was it because you straddled ethnic groups, or was it generally directed at non-whites? How did you, because of course race is such a charged topic in the US. I'd love it if you could share a bit more about how you experienced that.
Absolutely. I found myself, not belonging to pretty much any community. I didn't speak any English in the beginning, and that made it a challenge. And I couldn't speak Spanish in the beginning as well. I only knew Portuguese, and the Portuguese community was very small, and there was no issues for me there. But in the community, there was many different ethnic groups, living. And, going around in the different neighborhoods, you would find yourself with in contact with people from different ethnic backgrounds and so forth. And you were not easily accepted. And back then, it was much more challenging because it was much closer to the age when going to school was you were bused to different neighborhoods and with police protection. And actually, that was part of my experience. In my first year here to go to school, I was escorted by two police cruisers, one in the back and one in the front, to go to school every morning. And that was not... I thought it was cool and everything, but it also felt frightening that had to happen. And I came from an environment where you could, go everywhere and anywhere and any time of the night and never have to feel insecure about where you are or feel threatened physically. So that was very challenging experience. And it was culture shock as well for anyone that's making that transition. We eventually accepted the reality because it was going to be our new home. And I made it a feat to learn English as fast as possible. So within 6 months period, I could speak, relatively good English to, get by and also to, make sure that I understood what was going on. And eventually that experience of feeling isolated and not belonging and not being allowed to participate in many different groups and in school motivated me to learn as many languages as possible. And that's been a constant goal of mine to continue to learn other languages, other cultures, and not to feel isolated or to feel that you could communicate with others. And I can say that actual experience has, pushed me in the direction that I can speak, six, almost seven languages altogether. Wow.
And I was curious to ask you, like, how did that early youth experience that where clearly there was an element of bullying, of safety, the world is dangerous, how did that shape a little bit your worldview? Because then you chose to go a path of self-defense, but you don't strike me as somebody who's vengeful or violent at all. And so I'm just wondering what kind of worldview you constructed, and maybe did that plant the seed in a way for your decision to then go into politics at some point?
Well, absolutely. I can say without a doubt that the martial arts philosophy that I learned and the principles that we learned in studying the martial arts reassured a lot of the values that, you know, my family instilled in me. So that was a good fit, and I felt comfortable to be in that environment, and it helped to strengthen, you know, what I believed in to begin with, that, you know, people are good and you do good to others, and you should get the same back to you at some point. But the world doesn't function like that, as you know. For that matter, I believe that the philosophy that I learned definitely balanced off the physical training that you receive in martial arts. And in actuality, martial arts is not about being offensive, but being defensive. And it's a way of life. It's a way of being. And black belt is a mindset. It's something that is ongoing, consistent, and it is always evolving to improve the self and continuously make yourself better and find rooms for improvement. And I think that mindset is continuously with me. And I think it will always be, because we are always looking to improve, you know, myself and what I do. At the same time, to answer your question with regards to, you know, worldview, that exposure of being able to travel and being in the sports arena, I think sports does a lot for people. And competing at an international event gave me that exposure. But after competition with martial arts competition, everyone gets together and everyone celebrates. And we are all friends, regardless of who stood on the number one podium or received the grand championship trophy. We are friends, because today you may be standing there, but tomorrow I might be standing there, because a simple mistake that I made or that someone made allowed them to take that top-notch position for the day. But it could be quite different, and it actually Davis changed. Turn, yeah. Exactly. So it's very hard to stay number one for a long time.
Can you share how you got involved into local community, how you made that transition from competing in sports at such a high level to then being drawn into service, into community work, and into politics?
Sure. Well, during my early martial arts years, I found a passion, which was to work with kids and teach. And that opportunity was afforded to me by my instructor in the studio. And I felt that teaching was a powerful venue and an opportunity as well to be able to help others. And drawing from my own experience, what had transpired and what it did for me and how it transformed me, I felt really, really good in my ability to transmit and to help others, to instill confidence in themselves, to build their self-esteem and ability to defend themselves, all of that together. And I did it because I went through it myself, and I was a living proof that you could go from someone that was not very athletic, didn't have much ability, and was picked on and bullied and beat up for most of the time by others, to someone who's actually could stand up and defend others. So that to me was very powerful. And I felt that it was my responsibility to pass it on to others and help other kids. So when a parent came to the school and told me their challenges with their kid, that they didn't feel very confident, or they were not very confident, or that they had some, you know, behavioral issues, it was easy for me to work with them. It was natural. And I was able to deliver successful results in a short period of time. So that was very powerful. And the ability to influence others in a positive way is really something that can be addictive. And that has helped for me to work within the community and be connected to the community and, you know, be grounded to the roots where I come from. And I've always wanted to give back and contribute. And my way of doing that was to help as many other kids be in a much better position so that they would not have to face the same challenges that I did, and be stronger emotionally and psychologically to confront the real world. And to answer the question as to how I got involved in politics, traveling back to Cape Verde, I realized on many instances and many times that things needed to be better, that there was an opportunity to improve the political landscape with regards to the diaspora.
Things needed to be better, and what can you share more?
We were specifically talking about, a political party that had been in power for 15 years consecutively, and they begin to, let things go. And the public administration sector was not working properly, and you can sense, and there was lots of cry in the diaspora, people that would go back and want to open up their business or start something, and the bureaucracy was just very taxing. So for that reason, we felt that the diaspora community was not given enough support and attention, and that initiated a movement for us to work here in the U.S. and create a grassroots movement to help affect change in Cape Verde in a positive way. And because Cape Verdean citizens could vote from the diaspora, it is one of the few African countries that allows this privilege. As a matter of fact, the Cape Verde Constitution was set up in a way that allowed its citizens to vote in the diaspora before Portugal, which is quite an accomplishment. And we're a small, tiny country, but we always looking to do big things.
And so that's about 500,000 citizens in the country, and the diaspora is how big?
Well, we have probably tripled the size in the diaspora altogether.
No way. Okay.
Absolutely. Between Europe and the rest of the world and the United States, we could easily say that it will be almost triple the number outside of Cape Verde.
And so share a little bit how one gets into politics in this way, remotely almost, because I associate such politics as, you need local networks, you need to be able to be seen in the community. So how do you just kind of create yourself in this way, or reinvent yourself? Yeah.
Well, I was always connected with the community, and having been working in the community and teaching, I knew so many families and so many people. And but the Boston community is relatively small, and the Cape Verdean community here, almost everyone knows everyone. The politicians from Cape Verde visit the community very frequently, and there was always a political awareness. And I've always had a political inclination, even though I didn't start off my career in politics to begin with, but I was always politically engaged and active, and always reading and keeping up with geopolitical affairs and everything that's going on in the world, and understanding how things have transformed and as it goes on. So that awareness was always there. And that desire to want to make a change and see things working better and providing an avenue for other people and providing a voice for other people. The same way I was doing it for the children, I thought, okay, I can do this on a political level at a bigger, with a bigger platform, and help to influence change and provide some kind of service to the people and to the diaspora community by helping to bring change to the government and bring new ideas and new legislation, for example, to help facilitate things for the immigration community that's in the diaspora. And that's how the motivation and the grand vision started. But it always starts at the grassroots level, and it means visiting lots of people and sitting down at the kitchen table and talking to them about what you want to do, which is pure politics, and getting them to register with you so that you can create an organization. And we affiliated that movement with the Democratic Party in Cape Verde, and that got some political traction and support institutionally, and that made it much easier. So we needed to make that bridge and connect that bridge, because if it's just if there's no official structured system, then it's going to be harder to do so. So we created the organization and offshoot branch of the Democratic Party here in the U.S. which would be able to vote in Cape Verdean elections. And that means power. You know, people, numbers in politics translates into, you know, changes and transition into affecting, you know, policies and so forth.
And then, of course, this movement became successful, and you became a member of parliament. And how was that transition into actual government, where suddenly you were on the other side, and then you were faced with the tedium of having to actually pass legislation and get stuff done, and the minutiae of legislation and consensus and all of that kind of stuff?
Well, the experience that I had working with people in the community and also running my own personal business for a long time gave me a lot of people skills. And, you know, in politics, you do need to have a good baggage with people skills and common sense and also understanding your goals and objectives. So I was pretty confident that we could deliver going to parliament, but also I was very humbled to step into the arena and be able to learn from the pros that are there. And it was actually a university, an ongoing university. And luckily, halfway through, I decided to upgrade my education. And I thought that, you know, getting a master's would be the next step. And that's when the whole idea of Fletcher came about. Yeah. And applying for, you know, getting involved in international relations, because we were doing a lot of work connected with international security, international relations and diplomacy. And I felt that I needed to have more baggage and more knowledge in that region and with credentials. So I sought out to get a master's in that arena. And that's when Fletcher came about. And here we are today.
Interesting. Yeah, fascinating. And you mentioned also that in parallel to your political career, you also had a business. And you mentioned your long interest in international business as well. Can you share a little bit more how that came about, and also how the two kind of worked alongside each other?
Well, I ran a personal development martial arts center. I call it personal development because it's not just teaching martial arts. I was working to develop each individual student and help build character in them, teach them self-defense and self-esteem and goal setting, and also to become a better, stronger person through the martial arts philosophy. And martial arts was just a vehicle. Ultimately, my main focus was to improve the student as a whole. And we did that successfully for 2.5 decades. And because of a health issue, I had to make a pivot. And that pivot transitioned to getting involved in politics locally, which I talked about a little bit. And after that, it became nationally. And we were officially elected as member of parliament. And that experience helped to, you know, shape and guide me in the direction that we've taken, and the course we've taken has been shaped by those events. And as we go through life, events does shape your destiny.
I find your story really, really inspiring at so many levels. Like just your resilience in turning bullying and this kind of discrimination into a quiet power, and something that then can be passed on to other people. And then your desire to do good in the community that translates into a desire to effect change in politics and then become active. There's so many lessons that I feel young people can take in the US, but in the wider world as well. And I'm sure you've been reflecting on that as your career has changed and pivoted, and you're doing new things now. On inspiring young people to see adversity as a seed or a spark for positive change, and for participation, and for constructive bringing light into ugliness in a way. Just curious how you look at that, and then maybe is that a message you also try to give, or both in Cabo Verde and in the US?
Absolutely. I can say without a doubt that this has been part of my modus operandi for, you know, being able to help others and do things for others, especially youth. We are constantly involved with the school system in Massachusetts, in the community. And we are requested many times to go and speak to kids in the community, the Cape Verdean community, because people know me. They know my trajectory. They know what I've done and what I've accomplished. They come and ask for us to go and talk to the kids and give them some support and tell them that they can do it, because I was one of those kids that lived in the inner city of Boston, you know, four decades ago. And it's an opportunity to convey that message and to reassure them that, you know, if they believe in themselves and they work hard enough, long enough, they can accomplish things. And if you are trying hard along the way, you will find people that help you. And I can say that I've been helped. No one succeeds by themselves. You know, when you find that someone is working hard and you see their genuine interest, usually people will come to support you and help you. And it is through those efforts and having that awareness and realization and not put limitations on yourself or find excuses of why you cannot succeed because you were discriminated or because of other events that happened in your life. As I said earlier, events do shape your life, but it's how you perceive it and how you internalize it and how you choose to deal with it. You could, you know, blame everyone else for not being successful, or you could actually, you know, work hard and push all the nonsense aside. And there are a lot of good people out there that will come to your camp and support you. And that has been my experience and my story. And I try to convey that because I encounter many kids within the inner city that will say, you know, I will never make it because of who I am or because of the color of my skin. And I automatically stop them dead in their track and explain to them and tell them my personal story. And they connect and relate right away to know that, you know, I'm no different than you. I come from the same background as you, and we share so many things in common. If I can do it, you can do it. But there is a difference. You have to be willing to pay the price in advance before you reap the benefits. And that is where most people, you know, tend to fall short, where they're not, either they don't believe or they are not willing to pay that price because, you know, we are accustomed. We live in a society now, especially the new generation, of everything is supposed to be instant. That is not really how the world works. Technology innovation has helped us tremendously, but still hard work has its place and that cannot be replaced.
If you think back, I really like this topic. So sorry if we go into a bit of depth in that, but was there a moment where it was on a knife's edge, where that moment of bullying and pressure and despair, like you thought, okay, it can tip either way. And the fact that it tipped towards the way of hard work and self-discipline, what do you say? Because you did actually mention your family, as your upbringing as being an important part of that.
Absolutely.
Which is something that is a gift. It's not from you in a way. So for those that are on the fence and are about to tip one side or the other, just curious if you've thought about that. Like, could you have fallen another path, essentially?
Absolutely, Philip. I can say that it was very easy because we were constantly, you know, solicited to join and to take different routes, especially in the high school years. But by that time, I had already been very entrenched into the martial arts training. And we know that from today, after having done so many studies, that, you know, usually kids form their character between the ages of 5 and 12. And that's where they start to form their self-identity and know who they really are. And they cannot be very easily swayed and influenced if they have good network and support. And I had a pretty good network and support of people and friends that was close to me that I could spend time with, relatives, cousins on the weekend, and family, of course, my own family, my mother and father always was there for us. And I have 5 sisters, so they were always around as well. And the close-knit family environment never really broke down, even though we were in the U.S. I think that is very important, but when a kid does not have a lot of support at home, and then he faces a lot of challenges socially outside with peer pressure, it is very easy for them to find or fall into some sort of network and group that is socially accepting of them, or that they feel they belong, or that gives them, you know, validation and you know, recognition. And sometimes that recognition feels very good, but it's a negative recognition, or it's a negative environment, but they feel a sense of belonging. And I encounter sometimes in my talks today, as we go around talking to kids in school, that, you know, some of these kids are belonging to certain groups that are not very positive, but they tell you, that's my family.
Yeah, interesting.
and why? Because they feel that those are the people that they can relate to, and those are the people that supports them and that they spend a lot of time with. So it becomes an external family, because at home they don't have that structure, or parents are working 2-3 jobs and the family structure is not there to support them after school. So it makes it challenging, and usually not everyone, but many kids will end up going in the wrong direction. And I had that constant pressure to you know, follow the path of the fast life, which is not something that would pay off, because many of those classmates and friends that we had back then are no longer around because they chose the fast life.
And what I find really fascinating is this how this topic actually is something that's really close to your heart, that you're actually working on now. Through your work in diplomacy with Harvard, with the emergency preparedness, and this topic about countering violence online as well.
Correct.
And I'd love if you could maybe tell us a bit how you got into that space. Maybe help me describe what it is, because I find it hard to just describe it in a single sentence.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Help me out.
Well, this opportunity came about because, you know, going to Fletcher definitely opened up a new platform to enter the diplomacy work, but also being a very active member of the community and having the awareness of all the problems and challenges that are going on in the community within the school system. I've always wanted to do something to help out. And back in 2016, there was a counter-violence extremism project, a pilot project, which was sponsored by the Department of Homeland Security. And I was asked to be a consultant to that project, bringing in perspectives of the community based on the work that I was doing and working with children and my background and so forth. So I found myself with very high-level, high-ranking officials from the U.S. and also from the academia. In doing consulting. So, and I did not have the Fletcher credentials at that point. So I think I need to step into the arena and go back to college and get an official degree with accreditation from a reputable university if I'm going to be sitting in any one of these rooms. So that is also another motivating factor of why I decided to go to Fletcher. And to come back to the counter-violence extremism program, that's how it started. And of course, the seed was always planted there from knowing what we know in the community. And that opportunity led to eventually, once I went through my master's program in Fletcher, concentrated on international securities, and my thesis was done on counter-violence extremism between 5 NATO countries, and I did a comparative analysis. And I was mentored by the late incredible Professor Fosgraf and Professor Richard Schultz and all the other amazing people at the Fletcher School, which I hold very dear in high regards. And that gave me such a powerful support and instrument to be able to go out there with very high level of confidence. And I can say also from all the colleagues, all the friends and classmates and alumni that we've met through Fletcher has enriched this you know, my career path, and it has enriched my ability to reach out and connect with the right people. And then it led to the fellowship at Harvard once I graduated with this, you know, counter-violence extreme program that we had originally worked on as a pilot project, and it got funded by the Department of Homeland Security. And through this project, we've been able to apply for funding specifically to work on projects of counter violence online through the Department of DOJ, Department of Justice. And they funded the very first program in the district of Brockton, Massachusetts, which was $750,000 that we were able to get for the community to work on this program to counter violence online. And that affected over 8,000 kids in the community. So that in itself, after the pandemic, I think it was just the right time when I approached the city officials in the city of Brockton, Massachusetts, to you know, to see if they were interested in this project. And they were very excited about the project. And we made the connection for the group. And then we started the project and worked with them on the grant. And through Harvard, with Harvard, they were able to be awarded this grant, which is currently ongoing. And, you know, there's still a lot more work to be done. But that's how this project came about, because of the work that we're doing in the community here.
And what I find interesting is this is done through the public, the School of Public Health, right? At
Correct.
And so it uses a public health lens to look at this topic. And of course, you come in with the Fletcher background, the multidisciplinary approach. And of course, that's the essence of this program, is to bring in different stakeholders. So I'd love if you could share a little bit more, because before hearing about your work, I'd never thought about this topic as something to look at from a health perspective, and that would require so many different types of stakeholders to actually tackle it.
Well, because of that project, and also because of the Fletcher background in influence and education, we created an organization through Harvard and with Harvard, which is called the GSC Network, which is the Global Safety Network for people to that are professionals that are working on counter violence extremism. And we have involved more than 20 countries in that project and that platform, and it's actually ongoing. And we have been playing a key role with science diplomacy. And through this project, NATO Science for Peace and Security, we've been working with this project to bring changes and affect changes at local community level. And in 2019, we implemented this project in the Balkans using North Macedonia as a base to promote and instill this project at the local community level, working with many organizations, NGOs, government that are working on counter-violence extremism efforts. So this has been, it's taken us on an international level, and it requires diplomacy, and it requires international relations skills, which, again, Fletcher has given us a great platform to be able to work on. And it was actually very interesting once I visited the president of North Macedonia to find out that the Minister of Defense was also a Fletcher alum. Mm-hmm. So that was great.
We heard a bit about CVE in our studies, and it's a topic that gets quite a lot of coverage in academia. Correct. And there's also some criticism about whether it's still relevant as a concept, or it's an invention of a kind of the 9/11 days. What I find interesting is you come at it really from a local community delivery and with the know-how of how young people function and with a lot of practical experience. I was just curious about how you kind of saw that the fact that for many years, if you had a project with the CV, you got budget, but you actually look at it from, does it actually work? Can you actually make things happen on the ground? And also, I find fascinating that you built expertise in the US, and then you applied that in places that are quite different, like the Balkans.
Exactly. And I think that you know, the common ground here is that a lot of the violence that are happening always starts, you know, on the ground, on the local community level, and then they expand, and many of it happens because many of the youths are feeling disenfranchised, and many of them are feeling that they are left out of the system. They are, you know, they don't have a say, and they feel that it's only through violence that they can get attention and they can affect change. And when I have the opportunity to go into organizations that are working on counter violence extremism, say, for example, in North Macedonia, and we speak to people, we speak to officials and people that are working on the ground, and we communicate that this is a common thread, not just in their region, but it's, you know, pretty much everywhere. If we look at the Sahel region in Africa, we look at East Africa, no matter where we look at where violence extremism is something that is being used. But you can also say that it can also be hijacked for political purposes, and it can be politicized very much. But in essence, if we reach people at the community level and we're reaching families, it makes a huge difference, and it can make a difference, and we can affect change. And this is where I approach it with, you know, a very direct belief that, yes, we can make a difference. And I think that, you know, as Martin Luther King said, you know, if you're going to do something, do it well. If you're going to be a street sweeper, you know, be the best street sweeper. And I feel the opportunity that we have now working with Harvard, it's given me an opportunity and a platform to really push these agendas that are global. We are working on global health security issues. We're working on mis and disinformation projects. We are working on human trafficking project as well with the Department of Homeland Security right now. And we are working with NATO on these projects for science for peace and security. We have ongoing projects and proposals to bring in other NATO member countries with such of these projects. And we currently also are working on projects that are connected with the Five Eyes, specifically designated to address the mis and disinformation and risk communication. And my job is to facilitate and build that collaboration. I'm not an expert in any one of those areas per se, but what I do very well and I'm very confident in is bringing people together and have the ability to, present our project, our vision. And that has also led us to creating a collaboration between six universities, which is called IRIS Research Group. And this research group is working together with governments throughout the world on these very specific problems. And we have with us, through the IRIS Research Group, the tech companies such as, Meta, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft, they're all on board working with us. We do many seminars and workshops globally to help government officials understand the challenges and the difficulties. We conducted a recent seminar in Lisbon with 23 NATO member countries on mis and disinformation and the challenges of risk communication. And we kicked off that platform, and we led that effort to bring these organizations from academia, from government, and also from the NGO sector and the private sector, all looking at the problems that we've just outlined. So these things are giving me an opportunity to work and meet incredible people, very high-level professionals in many different areas, from counterterrorism to counterviolence extremism, international security issues. All these issues are on the table, but we are approaching it from a public lens of public health, and that is different. I've been able to publish an article based on that in the U.S. Homeland Security Journal Affairs, based on some of this work. And we have ongoing publications and collaborations with some of the best in the world right now. And I feel very privileged to have this opportunity and to have risen to this level. And thanks to the Fletcher education and exposure, I can say that without a doubt.
Yeah, it sounds like you're in an amazing place and really able to leverage all these experiences, both practical and theoretical, and from your heart as well, that you've developed over so many decades. I've really enjoyed our conversation, Alberto, and we have a little tradition to end these episodes with three quick question and answers. But before I do that, is there anything else that you wanted to share, or that's unsaid, or that's on your heart before we close?
Well, I think that the biggest room in the world is room for improvement, and we're looking to build this collaboration and build this exposure and bring more network to this platform that we're working on through Harvard. And I think that's something that will continue to be. But I'm always looking to as well bring some help and support in the developing nations, developing countries, specifically in the renewable energy sector. And I know you have some experience in the energy sector there. So on the private side, we are challenging ourselves to bring projects to developing countries in the sector of renewable energy. And we are starting with Cape Verde. We are actually bringing the very first solar desalinization project to Cape Verde. For agriculture. And this could be a pilot project for Cape Verde, but it could be the next step, bringing it to other African countries or to any other country that is interested. And with climate change and environmental challenges that we have now, I think it's the right step to go. And I'm looking forward to building that direction, that project.
Yeah, super, super exciting. Yeah, that would warrant a whole separate conversation. Indeed, there are a lot of fascinating opportunities in Africa on that, and very often, I mean, the cost of those things are really competitive. It's just very difficult sometimes. Absolutely. To get financing. The financial community is, or the financial system is not geared for that yet, with the high interest rates and debt issues. Correct. As well. But the fundamentals are very, very robust and interesting. Yeah,
absolutely.
So for our three quick closing question and answer, the first one is, anything you've read recently that has changed the way you see the world?
Well, it is not so much changed, but cemented the way I see the world. And then this is actually a book about the founding of Portugal. And I say that because recently we did a workshop seminar there where we involved the Portuguese government. And I kind of needed to strengthen my historical background and information with Portugal. So that gave me an even broader idea. You know, Lisbon, I came to find out that Lisbon is one of the very first global cities in Europe and the very first globalization project probably was Cape Verde.
Yeah. And then what's the title of that book, actually?
It's the founding of Portugal. I can send that to you.
I'll put it in the show notes.
With the authors as well. It was very fascinating because we ended up finding out that the colony of Brazil was founded from Portugal, from Cape Verde, rather. It was from Cape Verde. Cape Verde was one of the first colonies established, and it was used as a platform to launch the other colonies thereafter. So it was fascinating to know that we were older than Brazil.
Second question is, any habit or ritual that you practice that has improved your life?
Absolutely. Believing in myself that when you set a goal, that Mother Nature does not give you the capacity to visualize something and not have the capacity to actualize it and make it come to reality. So in other words, I've learned to believe that you begin with the end in mind. And if you do so, then you work to bring that end into the present and to actualize it.
So visualization.
Yes, I'm a very visual person. I can see goals happening. I can project what I'm looking to accomplish. And then I keep that image constantly focused in my mind until I accomplish that goal. And that training came from the martial arts.
That's really something I need to think about. That's very powerful. Last one is, any place that has special significance for you?
Wow, there are so many, but I will say that Boston is a very unique city because what I've been able to accomplish and the person I've become, I can say that the city of Boston has played a very powerful role. But I can also say that Boston is a place where actually the world comes together. To learn and then go back out and do good for the world because of its academic institutions and the environment. Today, Boston is very different from when I first came. I do love this city. I believe that it has so much to contribute and for the rest of the world. And I believe that what is learned here through the educational institution does affect powerful changes throughout. And we have so many great leaders in so many countries that have come and gotten the education in Boston. And for that matter, I think it will always be the hub and the base, but I'm a global citizen.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Alberto. I've really enjoyed our conversation. It's been amazing.
Oh, thank you so much. And a shout out to all the Fletcher stars that are out there.
Thanks for listening. If you're enjoying this podcast, there are a few ways you can help. Please click the follow button on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And also consider becoming a supporter by visiting atthecoalface.buzzsprout.com. Thank you.